Great. So first, I want to thank you all for coming out on this very soggy day. I'm sure traipsing through all the rain and puddles is not fun. But for those of you who did come, let's start with a little review of the quiz, because I think there were some questions in the quiz that gave people trouble. Sorry about the kind of small font, but I wanted to try to fit all this on one slide. So we'll start with question one here. So we have this kind of elaborate scenario here where we suppose the following sequence of things happens, and then we ask which of the steps will actually cause an exception other than a system call. Now, when I say an exception, I mean not a signal handler, although we do say a signal handler runs in step one. And the answer here is that we're only going to have an exception in, not counting a system call, in step one. So the control C is going to generate an IO interrupt that will cause the operating system's interrupt handler to run. And an interrupt is a kind of exception. So, let me get my pen here. And that causes an interrupt handler. Now, on step two, the signal handler that gets invoked, let me first say, the signal handler that gets invoked is being invoked in the operating system. So when it takes that interrupt for keyboard input, it says, oh, that keyboard input was a control C. I have to do something special for that. I have to deliver a signal to this process. And then it checks the signal handler mask. If there's no signal handler registered for control C, the default action is just to terminate the process. But if there is a signal handler registered, which there is in this case, we invoke the signal handler for that process. And now the signal handler wants to print a message to the screen, so that's going to invoke a system call, which is why we excluded it from the question. Returning from a signal handler is going to invoke the operating system, because that's the way the stack gets set up when the operating system invokes a signal handler. When you return from the signal handler, you go back into the operating system in this case. Now, if process B in step four wants to read a file, it's going to again invoke a system call. That's a write. We excluded system calls, so that's why it's not part of the answer. And in step five, the write system call, when there's no, so the write system call will typically, read system call. I said write. So in step four, when you do a read and there's no data already available in the buffer, the operating system is going to context switch to another process rather than just sit around and do no useful work. So it is going to do a context switch, but there's no timer interrupt here causing the context switch. It's the fact that process B did a system call that can't immediately be satisfied that causes the operating system to do the context switch. And actually, anytime you do a system call, the operating system has the choice to do a context switch. Yes, question.
In part five, when you're switching between process B to process A, there is no syscall, it is just a context switch?
In this specific scenario of step five, there's no system call, and there's no timer interrupt either. So the system call happens here when B does the read. Now, That read system call invokes the kernel, and one of the things that it will do is run the scheduler and say, should I run another process? So there's no extra system call or exception involved in step five. Yes, question.
So for step four, when the disk isn't ready to give the data, doesn't it raise an exception in the OS for that?
So the question was, in step four, if you try to do a read and the disk isn't ready, is there an interrupt of some type or an exception that's raised? And actually, there isn't. So what the operating system will do when you issue a read system call is it will go look in the file descriptor for the corresponding open file, make sure that you have the rights to read from that file, and then it will set up a command that goes out to the disk, and it will include in that command a buffer, the pointer to a buffer in the kernel space where the data that the disk is going to provide that you want to read should be written. And it will set up something called direct memory access so that the disk can send that data into that chunk of memory in the background while the CPU is doing other work. And that's all that happens. So there's no interrupt that actually happens associated with the read until that command is processed by the disk. And so there's really two scenarios. The disk could indicate some kind of error, or it could indicate it's completed transferring the data, and either of those would generate an interrupt. So another question. So the question was about a page fault specifically associated with step four.
Some sort of similar scenario where the data is not there.
Well, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, but I wouldn't think there would be any page faults associated with step four. So what the kernel is going to do when it gets the read request is it's going to allocate some pages in kernel memory that are set aside for the buffer that's going to receive the data from the disk. So then when the disk is actually sending the data that has been requested, the memory is allocated where the disk can directly write to that memory. I'm trying to think of a scenario involving the user level process where it, for its buffer, provides a pointer that causes a page fault. And there are some sort of corner cases, I suppose, but they would be pretty in scenarios that we haven't covered yet. Other questions about this one? So what we're trying to get at with this question is to differentiate between system calls, other kinds of exceptions, and signals that happen in kind of different scenarios, but they have sort of similar ways of being handled. And I see the question, give me one sec. I want to clarify that an exception is something that happens in the hardware. So a system call is a hardware instruction. It's an assembly language instruction, but it's actually the hardware that transitions into operating system mode and then from there invokes the system call, invokes the kernel in a sort of specific point in the operating system kernel code that finds the then correct system call handler and runs it. Other kinds of exceptions like faults or interrupts are handled the same way. It's just that they're not caused by an instruction that is trapping into the OS, they're caused by other kinds of events. Signals also have handlers, but signals are a software abstraction that allows the operating system to tell a process that's running that some asynchronous event happened, and if the process is interested in that signal, it can register a signal handler. And then when the signal happens, the operating system will set up the processes stack to run that signal handler, set the program counter to that process's signal handler, and by the way, transition into user mode and run the signal handler. And it will set up the return address in the stack so that when you return from the instruction, you go back into OS. We haven't really talked about the program stack yet, so I keep sort of referring to this amorphous concept, and we will get to that. Question?
So just to be clear, the context switch in 5 happens because of the signal, or the syscall in 4?
The context switch in 5 happens because whenever we make a system call, the operating system will also make a scheduling decision. Now, there is a way where we do a context switch and switch based on an interrupt. And so a timer interrupt is a specific way to make sure that when software is running that doesn't invoke the OS in any way and there are no other interrupts, that there's a way for the kernel to get a hold of the processor again and make a scheduling decision. So that, for example, if you have some really long-running code, like an infinite loop, or you're computing the nth digit of, you know, pi, that you don't tie up the CPU forever. So that specific scenario is where a hardware exception would be generated. It just doesn't apply in this case. And by the way, any other interrupt will invoke the OS, and it will typically run the scheduler at that time as well. Okay, so moving on to question 2. Same text above, but different scenario down below. Now we're going to look at these steps again and ask about system calls. And we didn't include step 3 because we didn't want to get into the details of how the signal handler returns back into the operating system. It's not actually a system call in the conventional sense, but it's a little hard to explain, so we just skipped step 3. Okay, so step 1 is not making a system call. There's first of all, an interrupt generated by the keyboard that invokes the operating system, and then a signal handler runs because the kernel recognizes the control C is special. In step 2, we already talked about this. There's a write system call in the system handler to print to the screen. In step 3, we skipped that. In step 4, we're doing a read. And then in step 5, we're already in the OS when step 5 happens. So any further questions about this? Okay, so questions 3, 4, and 5, I split it across 2 slides. People did relatively well on these, but we're trying to sort of differentiate between where the process state resides depending on the process's status. So X is actually running on the core. It's running on one of the cores of the CPU. Y is suspended and waiting for input. And Z is also suspended because of a context switch, because a timer interrupt happened and Z had its share of CPU time, so it got suspended so that X had time to run. So if a process is running on the CPU, your register values will be in the actual registers of the CPU. So the register RAX here on the hardware holds the value that process X expects to be in RAX. Now, if we sort of roll back in time to when Z was running on the CPU and the timer interrupt happened, what happens on a timer interrupt if the OS does a context switch is it copies state out of the CPU, so it copies all the register values to a place in memory. And then it takes whatever suspended process now is going to run on the CPU and copies its values out of memory and puts them onto the CPU. So it's like you've been in suspended animation and you got woken up. And similarly for the process that was on the CPU, you're putting it in suspended animation by copying all its state to memory. And it's just like frozen there at some instant in its sequence of execution. And when a process later gets put back on the CPU, it's like waking up from suspended animation. Just, it doesn't have any idea that it was asleep for some period of time. It just picks up where it left off. So any questions about X and Z? So question five drilled a little deeper for Y. So suppose that Y, in the question setup, Y is waiting for keyboard input. So let's say now I type something, and that of course is going to generate an interrupt, and the OS is going to say, okay, the process Y was waiting for the keyboard, so now that we've got keyboard input, we should wake Y up and let it run. Now that doesn't have to happen instantaneously. In the interrupt handler, the OS can just buffer that keyboard input and do something else, run another process. But eventually Y will get executed, get put on the CPU. And so in the question, the Y generates the interrupt, the OS says, okay, we've got keyboard input actually ready for Y, let's go ahead and put it on the CPU. So between when the key press occurs and we're back in user mode running Y code, what kind of things have to happen? Well, we have to run the interrupt handler. So this one is true. X was on the CPU, and it's being swapped off the CPU because we're doing a context switch. So all of its registers, including the stack pointer, have to be copied into memory, into OS memory, where it stores the state of a suspended process. And we have to get Y ready to run, so we have to copy its registers that were in memory while it was suspended and put those register values back on the CPU into the appropriate register locations. Question?
So in the case of process Y, the register values aren't actually being registered,
they're just stored on the table. Right. So the simple version of a context switch is that the process that is being switched away is you're copying its essential state and storing it in memory. So for every process, the OS has something called a process control block where it keeps some state about the process. So you copy those register values, you basically just, the OS is doing loads it's doing stores, it's storing the value that's in this register to the corresponding place in the process control block for Y. Then once it's done with that, it's captured all the state for Y, and now it's going to take the state for X and load those values from where they had been suspended in memory and put them back into the corresponding register locations. So that's how you can keep context switching and suspend a process, wake up a process, and do this as many times as you need. Now, I said the simple version because there are a couple of hardware features that make this a little more complicated. Notably, Intel processors support something called hyperthreading, where two processes threads can share a single core. So there's actually two sets of registers, and the OS can make a context switching decision about either of those. And so those are actually abstracted in most ways to processes and to you as the user as virtual cores that happen to be multiplexed onto one hardware core. If that's confusing, just pretend I didn't say this, but the context switching gets a little more complicated when you have hyperthreading. Let's see, there were two questions, you and then you.
So why aren't there two exceptions to Bernie's question? It's like there's input and output. Isn't there like you'd be waiting on like one input and then I believe there would be another for like when it actually like kind of like goes off as like do another thing, I believe?
So there is an exception for the key press. What's the second exception you had in mind?
I feel like you saw something on the slide where it's like there's like a second exception to like occur after, like there's the first one for the reading, but I might be wrong on that, but I felt like there was something like that.
I think in this scenario, there's only the exception that's caused by the key press.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
But we can certainly chat offline. Yes, and then I'll get to you. I can see the misunderstanding. Why don't you contact me offline and we can talk about that further. Sometimes it's a little hard to imagine. I totally understand the interpretation. Not one we were thinking about when we were trying to anticipate potential answers. And you had a question. So another question about option four and whether there's another exception associated with the context switch. So let me clarify a couple of points. One way that a context switch can happen is due to a timer interrupt, which would raise an exception. However, in this case, we get into the kernel when we take the interrupt associated with the key press. So there's an interrupt when you hit a key on your keyboard, and that generates an interrupt, which invokes the interrupt handler. And then once you're in kernel land, once you're in privileged mode running kernel code, now you are already in the kernel and can run the scheduler. So you don't need another exception to be able to run the scheduler. Now when the scheduler decides, okay, I want to make a context switch, it just does that while it's in the kernel. So there's a function that's basically, it's not called this, but it's basically context switch. And what that switch function does is copy the registers out from the process that was on the CPU and then copy the registers onto the CPU that from the process that was suspended. So that one of the things we really wanted to get at with this question is to clarify that you don't always have an exception to make a scheduling decision. Anytime you get into the OS, you're going to run the scheduler in the OS. But, and different OSs may make different decisions about whether you're always going to do a scheduling decision on every possible way that you get into the OS. But for most purposes in most OSs, that's how it's done. And the timer interrupt is just one of many ways that you can get into the OS. And it's there to preempt a process that's hogging the CPU. Question in the back.
This might be a dumb question, but I'm still a little confused on when interrupts are exceptions and when they are. Like in one day, the interrupt there wasn't an exception.
So there are no dumb questions, and that is a good question. Let me answer the first part of your question. So if you think of the Venn diagram, we have traps, faults, and interrupts are different types of exceptions. So an interrupt is one type of exception. Now, you had a second comment at the end that I didn't quite catch.
Then why aren't the interrupts in question? because they were exceptions that partition called.
So there's an interrupt associated with pressing Control C with any keyboard input. That's going to generate an interrupt. There are also exceptions that are happening here due to system calls, but we said don't count system calls in your answer.
Okay. Okay.
And in my little Venn diagram here, I should say traps includes syscalls. So if we drew the, I don't have space here, but if we drew the Venn diagram, we could actually say the bubble for traps has system calls inside that bubble and other kinds of traps. Okay, so in the interest of time, we should move on here. Question 6, this is particularly relevant to the lab you're going to do tomorrow. I'm sorry about the small font, but I kind of struggled to get this all to fit on one slide. So here is this question setup. You've got these two processes, PID 1000 and PID 2001. They're both running the same program. They're copies of the same program, but two different processes. So we typed A.out, then we typed A.out again. And they've each registered these two signal handlers. And then we say, make some simplifying assumptions here, and we explain what the write function call here does. This is not the write system call. Maybe we should have called it something else, but this is like a user level write function that does what we say there at the bottom. So now on this slide, I'm showing the same signal handlers, and the actual, question 6 was, if we send SIG user 2 to PID 2001, what are the possible outcomes? So one possible outcome, so first of all, if SIG user 2 is sent to PID 2001, it's going to run this signal handler, right? And what it's going to do is it's going to print B and then do a kill on PID 1000 and invoke that system call handler for PID 1000. And it's important to note that when you raise a signal for yourself, for the same process, it gets handled immediately. But if you raise a signal for any other process, it may not be delivered right away. So there's some non-determinism here in when this signal here is delivered to PID 1000. So PID 2001 is going to print B, so that's why these options are correct. That's definitely the first thing that happens. And assuming that there's not some other signal being delivered by something else to PID 1000, then we'll never print A, because we're not going to get into handle user 1 except by this route here. And so this can't be an option. Now, what happens next? One possibility is that the signal is delivered right away, and so we invoke this signal handler here, we print A, then we kill 2001, and so PID 2001 terminates. So that's one possible timing scenario. Another possible timing scenario is that when we invoke this kill system call and raise the signal to PID 1000, that the OS says, okay, I'm going to remember that signal, but I'll get around to it later. And it'll just return from the signal call handler. And then the signal handler will continue running and print C. So, so this is scenario one here. Scenario two is that we do this. We raise the signal kernel delivers it later, then we print C, then eventually we actually deliver the signal handler and invoke the signal handler here in print A, and that kills 2001. And then the third scenario is that, let me pick a different color. We do this, then we deliver the signal right away. The kernel makes that choice. It prints A, and then a timer interrupt happens. And the timer interrupt interrupts the signal handler before it can raise a signal back to user 2. Back to PID 2001. So blue was scenario 2. So in scenario 3 now, there was a timer interrupt after A got printed before the kill happens, and the context switch, the scheduler in the OS says, I'm going to run PID 2001 again. So it returns from this kill function and prints C, and then later the OS schedules PID 1000 and it finishes up and delivers the signal. So timer interrupts can happen anywhere at any time when you're reasoning about the way the code is interleaved. You have to assume, unless you have to assume that a context switch could happen at any point in time. So when we get around to writing multi-threaded programs where the threads have to cooperate on updating shared data structures, we have to be very, very careful about how we do explicit synchronization to make sure that threads don't corrupt each other's state or don't corrupt a shared data structure. Because context switches can happen at any point in time, threads have to actually sort of explicitly synchronize to make sure that one thread can finish doing something before another thread starts reading or modifying the same data structure. So any questions about this one? Yes?
Is it possible for the kernel to not be able to deliver a signal?
The question is if it's possible for the kernel not to be able to deliver a signal. Short of the kernel like crashing, it will check that the PID raising the signal has the same effective user ID as the PID that is supposed to receive the signal. And if they don't match, then it won't deliver the signal. I can't think of any other reason, but there are sort of arcane scenarios in that I might not be thinking of. But in sort of any normal scenario, no, I can't think of a reason why that would happen. Yes? So kill will return, I actually don't remember offhand what it returns when the signal is raised successfully, but you can look at the man page to see the return value. In this case, we're not using the return value. We're not checking that the signal was accepted by the OS. We're just sort of assuming that it's delivered. Just to keep the code clean, whenever you're making a system call, you always should check the return value and handle any kind of error that the return value indicates. So that is a sort of point related to your question. I didn't get the other part of your question. Can you repeat it? Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
After the line that kill 1000 and that triggered the handler for the 1000, what if the program running on the PID 1000 is running to the end, so that wouldn't be triggered. So that the handler wouldn't be triggered at all.
So I think you're asking when PID 2001 in that signal handler for user 2 there, when it raises SIG user 1 to PID 1000, what if PID 1000 has already exited?
Yeah.
And so then the kill will just not have any effect. So that is a fourth possible scenario. I see what you're saying. Let me go back to the... So what we envisioned at these is that these won't exit. But we didn't specify that very well in the question. Let's see. Yeah, we didn't specify that PID 1000 might exit. So, what we intended was PID 1000, either of these processes will exit. They're going to stay running. But you're right that we didn't specify that very well. And so if the kill to 1000 has no effect because PID 1000 has exited, which is actually another scenario where a signal doesn't get delivered. Maybe that's what you were getting at. But then this kill here has no effect. And so then we just print B and C and PID 1000 outputs nothing. So if that's what you were thinking, submit a regrade request. But the only way that that last option happens is if PID 1000 has exited. And from what we discussed in class, I can see why you were thinking in that direction, for sure. Any other questions? So I hope going over the quiz cleared up some details of exceptions and different types of exceptions and how signals work. And so now we'll switch to, let's see here. So now we'll switch to the slides I had for today. So we did the quiz review. I want to briefly review signals because you'll be using signals in lab tomorrow. Then we'll resume talking about fork and the other Unix process API calls. I have a suspicion we won't get to open files, let alone virtual memory, but that's what's coming up next. Okay, so last time we talked about signals and signal handlers. And I said this earlier in the class, that a signal is a way for a user-level process to be notified of events. And there are sort of two main categories that I've listed here. Signals have default actions. In most cases, the default action when a signal is delivered to a process is that the process terminates. I actually don't remember off the top of my head if that's true for every signal. It may be that there are some that are ignored. I'd have to actually go double check that. But a process can change the default action by registering a signal handler. With the exception of a couple of signals, SIG kill and SIG stop, that are defined not to be catchable. So SIG, well, there's an example. So SIG stop will always suspend a process. SIG kill will always kill a process. A signal to your own process is delivered immediately, but asynchronously to others. We saw that in the last quiz question. And then last time we talked a little bit about signal safety, the fact that you can be you can actually catch another signal while you're doing the signal handler, unless you have blocked signals. And then we started discussing Unix and Linux process API, and we talked about fork. And star NIX is kind of a way of referring generically to the Unix Linux family. You might see that term sometimes, not just in our stuff, but in general. So we kind of partway through, before we got into the more advanced stuff with signal handling, we looked at this fairly simple example. Supposing you wanted to actually catch a segmentation fault, and you wanted to do something in the process before the process gets killed. Oh, by the way, let me define some terminology here before we get too far. So raising a signal means that we're requesting that a signal be delivered. A pending signal is not yet delivered. And then delivering a signal will invoke some action, either the default or whatever the signal handler specifies. So if we're writing a program maybe where we want to make sure that we can get some data flushed out to disk before the program crashes, we might register a signal handler for a seg fault and other kinds of signals that might leave a file in a corrupted state. So first we have to declare this struct sig action, which is a data type. The variable name here that we're using is act. And then this struct has fields. So for the handler, we give it the function pointer for the handler that we have defined up here. So if you just give a function name without the parentheses, that's basically a function pointer. And so that's telling the kernel later where the function starts that you want to run as the signal handler. Now we're taking the mask that is another field in this act variable that is a struct, and we're taking the mask field, and first we're clearing it. So here we're making sure that the mask is all zeros, which means default action for all signals. Then we say for the flags, this restart field here, which basically says that in certain types of operations, if they get interrupted by a signal, when the signal handler returns, you should resume the operation. The other option is just to terminate. And then this actually so what this mask does, sorry, I didn't specify that very well. The clear mask means that we're not blocking any signals. So we're going to receive all signals. And now we're going to register for the specific signal sig seg v, whatever we said in this data structure that we set up. And then there's some options that we're not using. And so what this will do, this system call will tell the OS, okay, I don't want any signals blocked. And if I receive a seg v, I want to actually handle that with this handler. And then in our sample program, we invoke a seg fault just to illustrate by trying to write something to a random arbitrary fixed address, which is a hack that could actually be a legitimately allocated address, but most likely it's going to cause a seg fault. And of course, when this runs, it actually causes a seg fault, it invokes the signal handler for the seg fault, and that prints got sig seg v. Why does this repeat? Because after we return from the signal handler, we try to resume what we were doing. We repeat the same instruction. That raises another seg fault, and this will go on forever until we actually kill it with some other signal, like control C. Any questions on this? So some key signal APIs are sig action that registers a handler. Kill is a system call that you can use to send a signal. We saw examples of that. It's also a command line program that basically just invokes the system call. Pause will suspend a process until a signal is received. Sigprocmask is used to temporarily block or unblock signals. We just talked about that in the previous slide. And so this is the mask. And then we can also send that to sigprocmask to say, want to block signals. We talked about this last time. This is this timeline here. We looked at this in the last class that shows that when the OS recognizes that PID A is raising a signal, it kind of remembers that, but it doesn't have to act on it right away. Now, if you're raising a signal to yourself, it will get acted upon right away. So then we looked at this example, and in particular, this example, I want to clarify something from the last class. This is similar to other examples we've looked at, there's a key difference here, which is that in the signal handler, we exit. So, several people asked about this after class, and I wanted to point it out. This particular line never runs. So when we invoke this handler, we're going to, when we raise this signal, we're going to invoke this handler, which will write Y and exit. But in the previous example, we didn't know what the ordering would be or whether the signal would even be delivered, because it was possible that we raise the signal before the other PID ran. And I'm sorry, I'm getting my PID 1000 and PID 2000 examples mixed up here. This invokes this, which invokes this. Right, so this happens immediately. It delivers, it raises the signal here, and then it exits. So this code should never run. We put this sleep here to make sure, in a hacky way, because we're specifying an arbitrary time, which is never a safe way to do things, but we're trying to keep things to fit on a slide. This gives PID 2000 time to register its signal handler. So we print X, then we invoke this handler, which prints Y, then this exits. This kill returns, and then this exits. This line here does run. It ensures that PID 2000 hangs around until a signal is delivered. It prevents it from exiting, which was the problem that we had over here. So I just wanted to refresh everybody's memory on this. Any questions on this? So you should be comfortable with this example. By the way, the correct answer here is A. Because you'll be doing stuff like this in the lab tomorrow. Then we looked at some examples of how signal handlers can get interrupted and the problems that can cause. And the issue here is that this malloc could get interrupted by a signal, and then if printf uses malloc as well, see here like this, then the data structures inside malloc can get corrupted unless malloc is set to be signal safe. And the way you do that is, I won't go through the details of what happens there. You can go back and review the last lecture. The way that you make functions like this safe is that you can block signals using sigprocmask. Or if you only want to block signals for a single thread in a multi-threaded program, you'd use pthread sigmask. Blocked means a signal that's raised just stays pending until the process unblocks that. And then there are various ways that you can say suspended, but find out when signals happen. The most useful one, and the one you'll probably want to use in the lab, is sig wait, which basically says, I want to wait until a signal gets delivered, until a signal becomes pending, and then I can do something about it. So this is kind of an alternative to having a signal handler. It lets you find out if a signal has happened without having to actually write a signal handler, because your sig wait just returns when the signal is delivered, and then you know that signal has happened. And if you don't need some special handling, you just want to know the signal happened, then sig wait is sufficient. So if you want to block signals, you do sig proc mask. If you want to find out that a signal was delivered, you can either register a signal handler and make sure that the signal you're interested in is not blocked, or you can block the signal and use sig wait, or sig suspend, or some of these other things. So here's an example of using sig wait. So here we're just declaring a set of signals. We empty the set. Then we add sigint to this set here. So this set is now all zeros because we emptied it, except for a one in the position of sigint. And now we can say we want to block the signals that are specified in this mask. So this will block sigint, but not block anything else. And then in the sample program, we now have sigint blocked. We can say we're waiting for sigint, and we can call sig wait on this set that says we're waiting for sigint to be delivered. And the and num here will be filled in by kernel. And so if sig wait returns with a positive value, with a non-zero value, that means there was an error. Otherwise, if it returns with zero, that means the sig wait was successful. And when it returns, you know that a signal was received, and num gets filled in here with the signal that it actually is sort of notifying you about, which in this case is sigint. So any questions on this example? So a common paradigm here is you declare a sig set, you clear it with sig empty set, then you fill in the specific signals you're interested in with one or more calls to sig add set. So if I wanted to wait on more than just sigint, but let's say I also wanted to wait on sig user one and sig user two, I would do sig add set multiple times to add sig user one and sig user two to this mask in addition to sig int. Then I call sig prog mask to tell the kernel, here is a set of signals that I want to block. So at this point, after the sig proc mask completes, those signals are blocked, whatever I specified in the set. And anytime those signals are raised, they'll just be pending, with the exception of kill and stop. Then I can go on my merry way doing whatever I want. This is also a way to do something that where you can't afford to be interrupted by a signal, like malloc. You block signals until you're done with this critical function, and then you unblock them. Once they're blocked, you can do whatever you want. And then when you're ready to do something about these signals, you can either simply unblock them and they'll get delivered and raise any appropriate signal handlers or terminate the program or whatever the default action is. Or in this example, you can call sig wait, which tells the kernel those specific signals that are in my set here I want to wait for them, any one of them, to be delivered. And the reason we have the and num here is I could be waiting on multiple possible different signals. So in the example on the slide, I'm just waiting for sigint. So if I successfully return from sigint, num better be sigint. Sorry, if I successfully return from sigwait, num better be sigint. But suppose I specified some other signals too, like siguser1 and siguser2. Now when sigwait returns, I want to know what specific signal actually caused sigwait to return. And I get that from the num, which gets filled in by the kernel. Okay, so let's move on to POSIX process management. Let's briefly review fork. Fork is weird because when a process calls it, it makes a perfect copy. The only difference being that the return value of fork will be different in the parent versus the child. So we make a copy of memory. We make a copy of the file descriptors, and we'll talk about that later for file redirection. Copy of the registers. Now they're completely separate, independent processes. It's just they happen to be copies of each other. One of them will have a non-zero return value from fork, which will tell it the PID of the child. That's the parent. The other will have a return value of zero, and that's the child. So if we have a process that looks like this with some user registers and some address mappings and some open files, we call fork, we make a perfect copy. And true, so the simple version of fork makes a true copy, actually allocates new memory to copy every page from the parent into a fresh page in the child. And those pages that are newly allocated could be anywhere, but the address space, the virtual addresses, will look the same in the parent and the child. It's just that they point to different places in memory. So a given virtual address in the parent has an associated page, the same virtual address in the child will have a different page, but the contents will be the same because we made a copy. And then, for the return value in the parent, we set RAX here to be the child PID, and in the child, the OS sets RAX to be zero. And now the OS will set things up so that each of these processes is ready to return from the system call, and now the scheduler just makes a decision about what process to run. The scheduler could choose the child to run first, or it could choose the parent to run first. That's non-deterministic. So the way this looks in code is like this. You don't have to do get PID in the parent. This is just for illustrative purposes. So the parent is running along here, and it calls fork, and it remembers the return value of fork. So that now it can do if child PID is greater than zero, I know I'm in the parent. So I want to clarify, the child process is created here. So the parent will return from fork, and the return value will be non-zero. The child will also, once it runs, return from fork, and its return value from the fork system call will be zero. So this is really weird, right? We have one process, it makes a system call returns, that's totally normal. Then there's this other process that just suddenly happens, and it's magically already running inside fork. It's like, you know, some sci-fi where we just magically create a clone instantaneously that has all the features of the original. But yeah, that's how fork works. It just creates this new process. It's such an exact copy that the child looks like it's in fork. And when it returns, it will have access to all the state of the parent. So if there were any globals up here that were declared earlier, the child will see those because they're global and it's a perfect copy. So we capture the return value from fork here. And you'll also sometimes see the paradigm if fork, then, you know, if that's a non-zero, there's some parent code and you run the then clause. And if the return value from fork is zero, you run the child. So you can put the fork inside the if statement. Here we've separated it out by remembering the return value here and then doing this if down here. But yeah, if it's the parent, we run some code here. Otherwise, if the child PID is zero, we run some child code. And so some example output would be like this. And this is where we left off at the end of last class. Any questions so far about how fork works? So let's do an exercise. Let's look at this code. Suppose the parent PID is 99 and the fork creates a child and assigns it the PID of 100. Give two possible outputs. Talk to your neighbors and decide what some possible outputs would be. So in the interest of time, I'm going to move us along here. So here are a couple possible sequences. These are not the only possible sequences. The important thing to remember here is that any interleaving of parent and child is possible. So, so we could have the child wake up and start running. After the fork, the OS could choose the child to run first. And it could print, we'll take that again. So the parent does the fork, now the child gets run, it prints in child, it goes on and prints done, then we run the parent, which prints child 100 and prints done. Or the parent could return from the fork before the child gets to run, and it prints child 100, and then it gets a context switch, timer interrupt, now we run the child. And, you know, a third scenario would be in child, child 100, done. That's also a valid interleaving. So let's do another exercise. So here we have the fork, and then you can see that there's two different cases for the child, and the else, of course, is for the parent. What are the possible outputs here? Talk to your neighbor. So let's go ahead and, just in the interest of time, let's discuss the answers here. How many people think A is possible? Okay, how many people think B is possible? C, D, E, F. Okay, so the only possible answers are A and D. Because after the fork, these are two completely separate processes. They cannot affect each other's state. They're copies, but they're independent. They don't have access to each other's memory. So anything that's happening here in the child will not affect X and Y in the parent, and vice versa. But we don't know which order they're going to run, which is why both A and D are possible. So the reason we don't have interleavings like 1, 3, 2, 4 or 1, 3, 4, 2 is because the values are being printed down here in sort of one shot with the printf. Okay, so that's fork, and you're going to be using fork in an upcoming assignment, but now we're starting to get ahead of where the labs are, so we're looking a little into the future. But we've got material that needs to be covered before we're ready for the next assignment. And the next thing on our list is exec. Or some alternative ways of creating a new, of taking a, well, in the case of POSIX spawn, creating a new process and setting up a new program to run. So what exec does is it replaces the current process with a new program. And there are many variants of this. There's execv, there's execv, there's execl, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The simplest one is probably execv. So it takes a path to the program to be executed. And you're going to set up the argv for this program. So when you get argv in main, it was set up something like this way. And then there are other variants that can have argv provided in a different way. Here it's provided as an array of strings, and also to specify different environment variables, which are some state that's sort of in the background that's available for processes. So here's an example of how you'd use this. let's say you're in the shell and you read a command line. Here we're just kind of hardwiring it. We fork, and in the child process, now we set up the argument. So let's say we want the child to run ls minus l. So we set up argv. Argv of 0 is always the program name, ls. And then all the remaining elements in argv are the arguments. So that's what we're setting up here. We're setting up an array of strings that is first the program name and then the arguments. And then we run execv. This is the actual ls program. And here's the argv that we've just set up. Now you might notice that here I said bin ls and here I said ls. That's actually not really what you would do. You typically want these to match. We just did it this way to illustrate exactly that point. They don't actually have to match. If for some reason you don't want the child to know that it's running slash bin slash ls, if you only want it to know that it's running ls, you could do it this way. And then we can check whether execv returned an error. And if it did, we can exit. So what's happening here is the child tries to run execv. If execv succeeds, this code never runs, because at this instant, the exec turns this process into the new program, and we start running this brand new program. So fork returns twice, exec never returns if it's successful. It's a little weird, but it works. And then in the parent, we can do whatever we want. But this is a typical way to use exec. You fork, and then in the child, you exec, and now the child is a new application. Question.
So just make sure I get it right. When the child would then become a new program, but the parent would still be able to run when
right.
Scheduled.
So a good example here is a shell. The shell reads the command line. Let's say the command line is ls minus l. The shell forks. The shell sets up the arguments to be ls and minus l. Then it calls exec to actually run ls. And this child will become ls. It was a copy of the shell until the exec, and then that process becomes ls, and it can find out what the arguments were by looking in argv. Question?
So is the child fork only able to ls from the bin, or like, would it be able to ls outside of bin?
So the child is just running shell code, and you can say anything you want there. When you say exec with a specific absolute path slash bin slash ls, that is the only ls that it will run.
Okay.
Now, you can use exec in a way where you just specify ls and rely on the path to find an available copy of ls. So that's another way that you can do it. Here we specified an absolute path, so slash bin ls better be there and you better have permission to run it, or this will fail. Any other questions? So let me very briefly explain. These slides are pretty self-explanatory. What's happening in memory? So here's the child. And when we do the exec, we're actually allocating new memory for a new process, new stack, new heap, new program text. So we're allocating even more memory, but then we can set up the new process exactly the way we want, and we don't have to worry about coordinating when we change stuff with the current version of this process. And then once we're done, we have a completely new process running a new application. The only thing that has not changed is the file descriptors, and we'll talk about that on Thursday. And once we're done, we can deallocate the old memory of the child, because now we've exec and set up new memory and set up the new application. So before we break here, any last questions about exec? All right, see you all on Thursday. Thank you.